we're breaking into scheduled programming now to bring you breaking news on a major police operation underway in Sydney's eastern suburbs.
40-year-old Joel Couchy fatally stabbed six people in the attack on Saturday.
This is a parent's absolute nightmare when they have a child with mental illness.
The Australian Assyrian community's in shock after a stabbing attack in a Syrian Christian church in Sydney's southwest.
At 1:35 a.m. this morning, after consideration of all the material, I declared that it was a terrorist incident.
Honestly, if you've got any influence on your friends and family, ask them to switch off the social media at the moment.
I'm not interested in your spin or your bullshit. This is a Senate inquiry. Answer the question.
In this term of Prime Minister Albanese's government, student debts are going to rise by 16%.
Australia no longer has the luxury of a 10-year window of strategic warning time for conflict.
I've just gotten confirmation from a US official that Israel has indeed struck Iran tonight.
Bruce Lehrman has lost his defamation case as Justice Michael Lee found that Ms. Higgins did not consent to sex and that Mr. Lehrman was indifferent to whether she consented.
Having escaped the lion's den, Mr. Lehrman made the mistake of coming back for his hat.
The rap.
Joining me now to wrap the week in news and current affairs is journalist, author and academic Margaret Simons. Great to have you on the radio.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And economist and former Labor Minister for Trade and Tourism, Craig Emerson. Welcome back to you, Craig.
Thanks, Andy.
Let's start with the Lehrman verdict. Australia's productivity plummeted dramatically for a few hours on Monday, with tens of thousands of people glued to their screens to watch Federal Court Justice Michael Lee deliver his verdict in the defamation trial brought by former Liberal Party staffer Bruce Lehrman against Channel 10 and journalist Lisa Wilkinson over her interview with the former colleague Brittany Higgins, who alleges she was raped by Lehrman in the offices of Linda Reynolds in Parliament House in 2019. It's a lot to remember and to recap, but I think it's all a story that people would be talking about a lot this week. In the end, the truth defence prevailed, with Justice Lee declaring that on balance, that Bruce Lehrman did rape Brittany Higgins. It must be stressed that this was a civil finding, not to a criminal standard. Margaret, you wrote a very compelling critique of this verdict, arguing it wasn't just a loss for Bruce Lehrman, but also a pretty damning indictment on the journalism in this country. Tell me more.
Yes, I'm not actually being critical of the judgment. I thought it was a very fine judgment. But yes, although Channel 10 won the case because Bruce Lehrman was found, as you say, on the balance of probabilities to be a rapist, all of the media whose conduct was examined as part of this, principally Channel 10, of course, but we also heard a lot about Channel 7 and a little bit about news.com, all of them were found wanting. And Channel 10's, the other defence Channel 10 was relying on was reasonableness of conduct. And it was clear that they failed on that comprehensively. They basically made up their mind very early in the piece, before they even did interviews, that this was a story about a political cover-up, about Brittany Higgins being forced to choose between her career and pursuing a rape complaint. And there was virtually no evidence for that at all, and quite a lot of evidence that went the other way, but that didn't stop them framing the story in those terms. So it was true that Brittany Higgins was raped, but the political conspiracy and cover-up, which was the way they framed the whole story, was completely wrong.
Yeah, I think the celebration from Channel 10's lawyers, we heard that on RN Breakfast. We also heard a statement from Lisa Wilkinson on the steps of the courthouse. Do you think those comments and that tone was premature, given that we still have the damages and the second part of Justice Lee's judgment to come?
Well, a win is a win. You've got to give them that. If they hadn't succeeded on the truth defence, then that would have been devastating and they would have been facing, I imagine, considerable damages, despite Bruce Lehrman's less than desirable behaviour. But yeah, I mean, Channel 10 obviously would prefer that we either didn't know or overlooked the criticisms that were made of the network. And, you know, really they were quite devastating, I thought.
Craig, no doubt your interest would have been piqued by Justice Lee's comments on the actions of the parliamentary staffers who supported Brittany Higgins in the weeks after this happened in 2019, particularly Fiona Brown. This must have been a moment of enormous relief for her, you'd imagine.
Well, I don't know Fiona Brown. I've never met her, but I feel so sad for what she has gone through. Margaret has explained very clearly that that Justice Lee, and thank goodness for him, said very clearly that there was no cover-up. Yet Fiona Brown was accused of being involved in a cover-up. She did everything she reasonably could. She took advice from officials in relevant departments, sought to assist Brittany Higgins in any way that she could, and ended up being accused of being involved in a cover-up. It's been a long journey for Fiona Brown, completely on the evidence of, or the judgment of Justice Lee, an unjustified, unwarranted attack on her, and she's been to hell and back. She has been to hell and back, and I think of her as someone who's just tried to do the right thing and had allegations, you know, awful allegations levelled against her, which have been established to be untrue and unwarranted.
What do you think about Linda Reynolds in all of this? Do you think she was vindicated to an extent?
Well, Margaret, do you want to go first?
Yes, sure. Look, to some extent, I mean, I don't think Fiona Brown and Linda Reynolds would say everything they did in handling this was perfect. For example, there's the fact that Brittany Higgins was interviewed in the same room where she'd been raped. That has already been acknowledged as being less than ideal. And, of course, there's the wider issue of the work environment at Parliament House, which there's been a report on and has been the topic of, you know, a great deal of news coverage. So it's not that there's absolutely no issue here. But yes, the allegations that there was an attempt to cover up and to discourage Brittany Higgins from reporting, there is no evidence for that and quite a lot of evidence the other way. And we saw that coming out during the hearings in this case. You know, there were transcripts of interviews with Brittany Higgins, and, you know, it was quite clear that they weren't discouraging her from reporting. I have no doubt that some people in the Liberal Party would have preferred that the whole thing had never come to light, but there's no evidence that there was an active attempt to cover up.
And that's right, and it appears that Linda Reynolds, if anything, was wanting Brittany Higgins to go to the police, and there was a question as to whether Brittany Higgins should decide that rather than... So if there was any pressure or any urging, it was not for her to refrain from going to the police, but to go to the police. And Fiona Brown wanted to, in the circumstances, give Brittany Higgins agency, as I understand it at least, to make her own decision about that. But, you know, Linda Reynolds is being accused of wanting to cover up when the evidence that Justice Lee provided was that it was quite the opposite. She was trying to get her to go to the police. So really... you know, there's very, very few people who in the whole thing who have come out, you know, unscathed. But I'd say Fiona Brown definitely, and the allegations against Linda Reynolds seem to be not based in any fact on any factual evidence.
And just briefly, Margaret, I mean, we've got to remember that when, and you've pointed this out, that when Brittany Higgins ventilated these allegations, both in the public and the media, you know, it was very much in the zeitgeist of the period. There was anger about the Canberra bubble. There was the wash-up of the Me Too movement. Do you think that all of those issues clouded the judgment of journalists, in your view?
I think that's probably right. Yes, you're quite right.
Does that include Lisa Wilkinson?
I can't speak for her. It's a question you'd have to ask of her. But, you know, as I say, it's not that there is no issue here. We, you know, there's been plenty of evidence, the Jenkins report, for example, which tell us that there's serious problems with Parliament House as a workplace. It's a toxic environment. There's enough background to this story to tell us that. Things need to be done about that. There is room for reform. So in that climate, it was around the same time as the unproven allegations against Christian Porter were circulating. It was after the Four Corners Canberra bubble program. Other Liberal staffers had come forward complaining of sexual harassment. So, you know, I think there was a temptation to think, well, here is another example. Sounds true, easy to believe. It seems to have segued very quickly into must be true. And also it has to be said that Justice Lee drew a contrast between Brittany Higgins' evidence about what actually happened and the rape itself and the immediate aftermath of that, and the claims she was making at the time that she first goes public, when it's quite clear that Brittany and her then partner certainly saw this as a political story and were pitching it to Channel 10 as a political story that was about cover-up. But that they came to believe that, or they came to put that forward quite late in the day. And Justice Lee found Brittany Higgins to have been largely truthful about the rape and in the immediate aftermath of the rape. But something seems to have gone wrong when she came out in 2021 in terms of her belief, and it's easy to feel sympathy for her. She was, she realised that this story was about to become public, whether she wanted it to or not. That must have been traumatising. She'd been the victim of a traumatising and violent crime. But she clearly came to believe that she was the victim of a political cover-up, and that wasn't true.
If you just joined me on RN Drive, this is the Friday Wrap. Great to have the company of two very fine observers of Australian news and current affairs. Margaret Simons is a journalist, author and academic. Craig Emerson, a former Labor Minister for Trade and Tourism here. Let's just talk briefly about the incident in Sydney earlier this week, New South Wales. Of course, it was left reeling following two separate brutal knife attacks. Just days after the Bondi tragedy, a 16-year-old boy stabbed a Syrian Christian cleric, Mari Emanuel, in what New South Wales police and ASIO have deemed a terrorist incident. Craig, some have attempted to make comparisons between the events in Western Sydney and the appalling stabbing attack in Bondi Junction last Saturday, which saw a very mentally ill man murder six people. It's been suggested that because he focused this attack on women, that this should be considered ideological and an act of terror. What do you make of those assumptions or claims?
Yeah, I just frankly don't understand that at all. I do understand that he targeted women. There's no doubt about that. And how would we know what is in his mind? But it wasn't an ideological or religious issue here. He was diagnosed, as I understand it, with schizophrenia, and maybe he attacked women before because he thought they were an easier target. I just don't know. But to suggest that that's an act of terrorism, I think, is qualitatively different from the one in Western Sydney where, you know, you had a priest attacked for what he said or what he believed in by someone else who had a different belief. Now, that does, I accept, constitute an act of terrorism, but let's not kind of throw a blanket over all sorts of crimes and say that because if someone behaved in a particular way, that automatically is an act of terrorism. I don't think that works.
Margaret, I mean, it seems to me that in the lack of any rationale, particularly in the case of the Bondi Junction attack, people are wanting to seek answers, which is why social media became such a bin fire, you might say, over the last week. But that want to understand is very real. But then when we're trying to assume or assert certain characteristics, this idea of targeting certain groups, I just wonder if that holds, because we know that the Prime Minister has come out this week saying that domestic violence is a crisis, one woman killed in by an intimate partner or someone they know every week. I should add that I think 70% of homicide victims are men. So it depends on the crime we're talking about here. Do you think we should be calling the domestic violence terrorism? Is that the kind of connection that people are making?
I think we can draw comparisons. I agree with what Craig said. I don't think we know enough about what was going through this man's mind. And clearly he was extremely mentally unwell. I'm just so glad that we have the gun laws we do in this country, or I imagine there'd be many more dead. But we really don't know enough. And I feel for the police, you know, in having this criticism thrown at them when they're applying the legal definitions, which is politically and religiously motivated violence, and doing the best to do their jobs. But I do think, I mean, let's be totally frank about this. A woman who is a victim of violence in her home from her intimate partner is absolutely living in a state of terror. Do we want to call it terrorism? Well, there is a political element to it. Men's the patriarchy and so on, these are political issues. But do they fit the current legal definition of terrorism? Well, I'm less concerned about spending time worrying about labels and legal definitions. I just wish we would have comprehensive targeted action to tackle the problem. There is absolutely no doubt that intimate partner violence and domestic violence are the biggest human rights issue in this country, the biggest criminal story, the biggest news story, the biggest health story. And that's not new. That's been the case for some time now. And we need consolidated action, urgent action across many different fields in order to get serious about tackling this. Let's not spend time, worrying about the words so much. Let's get some action on this.
I just want to move on to another topic that really lit up the text line this week. Quite surprisingly, I thought that Hex was perhaps not an issue that people from, say 50 to 65 years of age spend much time thinking about. But I was surprised because many of the people texting me were complaining about the levels of debt for their children. This age-old trope of the poor uni student is fast becoming a reality in Australia, with Hex debt set to rise between 4.2 and 4.8% this year, the second highest rise in a decade. Craig, I mean, historically, Hex debts have been championed as the lowest risk debt to accrue because of a long time, really for a long time, they were indexed at a very low percentage. Last year, these debts were indexed at 7.1%. This year, they're looking likely to inflict even more hurt on students and graduates. Have uni students been lured into a false sense of security with these loans, do you believe?
To me, it's the rate of indexation. The idea of HECS is sound, and that is, in a sense, paying for the benefit of your own higher education rather than expecting other people to pay for that. And it has resulted in a very huge expansion in the number and proportion of young people going to university, which is good for them and good for the country. But on the specific issue of indexation, it must be disheartening. I saw one example of someone who, having paid back $20,000, now owes more than she started on. And this is part of potentially a real intergenerational divide here where, with high rents, high house prices, HECS debts, young people, I fear, are just going to get resentful of older and wealthier people. And we need to do something about this. We don't, as a society, want that sort of divide. But if young people just feel they can't get ahead, that's what will happen. The Prime Minister has said that he's going to be looking at that with the Treasurer in the upcoming budget. But we just need to be mindful of this sort of resentment of younger people towards wealthier older people. We don't want a divided society. And so we should be adopting whatever measures we reasonably can to prevent that.
Margaret, the humanities, of course, is your area of specialisation. Mm-hmm. This week we learned that despite the Morrison government increasing the fees for these courses, students are still choosing to study them. Is it time to scrap the Job Ready graduate scheme, do you think?
Oh, past time. I mean, this is no surprise to anyone. When the Job Ready graduate scheme was introduced, there were many commentators, including some who were previous Liberal Party staffers, who were saying this won't work, this will all have to be unpicked in a few years. And here we are. It would be so nice if we hadn't had to go down this this detour, which has done nothing except make a lot of people very stressed and has achieved none of its aims. And, none of this is a surprise. Everybody who knew anything about this field was saying that this would be the result at the time. What does it take to get governments to listen?
This segues nicely into the other sort of intergenerational issue that we've been talking about this week. And I should say on the text line, lots of people, younger people saying when they go to try and get a loan, their bank manager has noted their HECS debt. And this is another barrier for the issue that we talk about a lot on this program, rightly so, is the housing crisis. But the other intergenerational issue here is this idea of a baby drought. How can we convince Australian women to have more babies? There's this new data from the Australian Bureau of Statistics showing that we're experiencing a near record low fertility rate with Australian women giving birth to just 1.6 babies on average over the next 5 years, well below the international average of 2.3. Margaret, you'd remember the baby bonus we heard from Peter Costello last hour. It had a brief success, but it didn't have an overall success on our declining fertility rate. Is it time to bring it back, or do we need to think outside the box here?
Well, I think there was a bit of a bump, wasn't there, in the birth rate
there was
as a result of the baby.
Quite literally.
Yes, exactly, literally. Look, I think there's multiple causes here. It would be worth doing some, you know, some in-depth research, you know, focus groups and so on to dig into this. But what I suspect is going on is partly the cost of living crisis, the housing crisis, giving people pause, but also the state of the world, climate change, all the wars. Anybody who is thinking of having children would have to be thinking, you know, what's the future hold for them? So I suspect we need a response across a whole range of indicators.
Yeah. I have to say that if there's a number one concern that I read on the text line every day, it's about the fears of overpopulation, the fears on, you know, natural resources being strained, fears over the rate of migration to this country. Craig, as an economist, what do you make of these arguments?
Well, the 1.6 children that you mentioned on average is below the replacement rate. So if we didn't have immigration, our population would start shrinking sooner rather than later. This is almost a global issue. Your listeners might be surprised to hear it's one that's affecting China, whose population will shrink, maybe even in half, you know, in the foreseeable future. I'm talking about several decades. And so what Australia does to deal with this is we look for young people from overseas, and that's very much where our immigration policy, you know, is targeted, to get young people. And I might just mention, it could be of interest, we're quite competitive on attracting young people to our universities because we have a smoother pathway to permanent residency than a lot of other countries. So that's overall good for Australia. I'm not sure if it's good for the world, but it's good for Australia. The other point I'd make is that women are waiting longer before they have their first baby. And that could be for all sorts of economic reasons, hopefully including that they're going to university or higher education. And I think that is a good thing too.
I think
the idea of a new baby bonus, you know, we laughed about a bump, but that's all it would be. I don't think it's a long-term solution.
A pretty blunt tool, yeah. Margaret Simons is the journalist, author and academic. Craig Emerson, a former Labor Minister for Trade and Tourism. So great to have you both. Have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
ABCRN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.